old figure, Bardell. I refuse to pronounce the name wrong, so it has to be Neil. You have to be Icelandic to say it properly. Otherwise, I'm known as Neil O. Bardell.
Where you were born?
Well, I was born in Winnipeg in 1904, and all of my life was spent in Winnipeg, and went to school and high school, and then I went down to Chicago and worked on the railway, and finally wound up in the mortuary science school, became a funeral director, came back to Winnipeg. And then later on, during the dirty 30s, I was invited to join the regiment and earn a commission, and I joined the Grenadiers on April the 8th, 1935, and stayed with the regiment all through the war, and even after the war to help them reorganize while I was retired in 1951, March the 3rd.
Did you, what rank did you get as a commission?
I started off as a second lieutenant. After having earned it, it takes 2 years. And then after 2 years, they give you your second tip. And you see, a second lieutenant is an untried wonder. He's much insulted and much maligned, and until he gets a second tip, he's not even a man yet. And getting my second tip then, I carried on with the regiment, and before the war broke out, I was a qualified captain according to the Royal School of Infantry. And on May, I think it was around the 24th of May, around the 18th, 24th of May, I don't remember exactly, 1940, the regiment took off for the West Indies and Bermuda. And my company, A Company, was taken off at Bermuda, where we stayed for 3 months, and then rejoined the regiment in Jamaica, and we stayed in Jamaica until September of 1941, when we returned to Winnipeg. Now, during the time we were in Jamaica, I was given the job of being transport officer. And when we were about to leave Jamaica for Winnipeg, I was made adjutant. I became adjutant at Winnipeg. And then we, in October, I think, was on the 24th, I may be wrong, we embarked wrong way, Corrigan, going west instead of east to a place unknown somewhere in the Pacific. And
at that time, were people sort of aware that there was going to be a war in the Pacific, or was it just garrison duty, much like Hong Kong, that you were expecting?
Definitely.
Or much like Jamaica?
Definitely garrison duty, because we heard that the other regiment coming with us had been doing garrison duty in Newfie, Newfoundland. Mm-hmm. And they were the Royal Rifles of Canada. And they were on the CNR, two trains of Royal Rifles, and we were on the CPR, two trains of Grenadiers. And we met in Vancouver and got on board the New Zealand ship, Awatea. Now, we had some troubles. We had a few deserters, and I think the Grenadiers had all the deserters. We had about 40 deserters, and I, as adjutant, was very embarrassed. And when we took off to sea, it took me a whole week to find out who deserted. And with the help of Colonel Hennessy, senior administrative officer with the brigade, we were able to report back to Canada from Hawaii, the exact people who were deserted. Now, after we passed Hawaii and we got to about the international dateline, we were told by Brigadier Lawson that we were now en route to Hong Kong, and the situation generally speaking. And we expected to have to almost fight our way ashore. Things were really bad, and we were told about the Japanese, they couldn't see very good and so on, and no problem at all fighting the Japanese. And we got to Hong Kong. We stopped at the Philippines first, and we were joined by another escort, and the Prince Robert, our Canadian ship, was with us, and the Canadian Navy, and the other one was, I forget the name of it, British destroyer, or light cruiser, I should say, went right through the entire Japanese fleet, because they're only a few miles away from us, through the South China Seas.
Well, there was no hostilities at that time.
No.
It was all quiet.
Well, you can imagine, we landed in Hong Kong on November the 16th. Why, I'm absolutely certain of that, it was 2 days before my birthday, the 18th. Now, as we got to Hong Kong, I know that we got the fellows ashore, 900 some men. We'll say 920 grenadiers, because we're supposed to have 960 full strength, with 40 deserted. I'm just guessing at 920. And they all lined up, and I was supposed to give the command to bring them to attention. It was turned over to me by the RSM, Paddy Keenan. And I said, Paddy, I haven't got the voice. I can't even shout above a whisper. All this excitement. So Paddy, I asked him to please give the command. We started off from there. And we wound up in Sham Shui Po Barracks, which was a military barracks of some size, easy enough to hold two regiments, and settled down. We were assigned an officer of the Royal Scots by the name of Major Byrne. It's a liaison officer, and to show us our duties and where we're supposed to go. Anyway, the important thing is, in settling down, fortunately, on the day before hostilities commenced, Brigadier Lawson decided on his own that we better go to Ireland and take up our positions, which the Royal Scots had vacated, with taking up new positions on what they call the Gin Drinkers Line, which is the line on the new territories which the our defenders had formed. Royal Scots and other troops, Indian troops and otherwise. We went up then on a Sunday, which is our December, that is China side, December 7th, your December 6th, and we got into our positions on the islands, and of course next day, our December the 8th, your December 7th, at 6 o'clock in the morning, these planes came over. Now, we were expecting some planes for ourselves, Spitfires and so on, and these didn't look like Spitfires. When they started dropping bombs and shooting up, they concentrated on Sham Shui Po Barracks, where they thought we were all housed, but only one company was left, was reinforced. But all the names quite clear, but I forget my memory.
I'll go and get it. Mm-hmm. Can you show me where Sham Shui Po was on the map?
Where's this island? The island here, the key is Stonecutter's Island. There's a key. Stonecutter's Island.
Oh, I guess it would be Sham Shui Po right here. Eh? They have it in. There's an island there, and there's Sham Shui Po over here on the mainland. This is up here.
There it is. Here.
Mm-hmm.
That's Stonecutter's Island.
And so when you started the fighting, when the fighting commenced, the men were still up here on the mainland, right?
Yeah, they're taking our position here.
Mm-hmm.
That's
and the Royal Scots.
We weren't here. Oh yeah, our one company was here, and the rest of us were here
on the mainland,
yeah.
Or on the island of Hong Kong.
Yes. The Royal Scots were originally here,
mm-hmm.
position, and we took up their position.
On the island, and then you went back.
Watch that gap, one nation.
And according to our maps, the Japanese came down over this corner into Hong Kong.
The Lai Moon Pass. Lai Moon Pass is a narrow one here, and they came straight across.
Did they come by boat or landing vehicles?
Oh,
or? How many were, what was the approximate force, do you remember?
Well, before they started off in the strength, they just battered the shit out of our pillboxes and all guns.
Mm-hmm.
And they battered the hell out of the day before, the 18th of December. And they came across the night of the 18th.
Mm-hmm.
And they were well up there in position. And they came up to Nullahs. You know what a Nullah is?
I'm not sure.
Open drain. And they got up this opening, led by people who were helping into position at here, Jardine's lookout up here.
Mm-hmm.
They came up this tunnel from this Lai Moon Passage here, Lai Moon Passage right there,
mm-hmm.
came right up here. There. Mount Butler, Mount Parker, these are all Grenadiers.
And you were positioned over in the.
Our middle. Headquarters of the Grenadiers was Wan Chai Gap right here.
Uh-huh.
And the headquarters of our Wan Nai Shang was a brigade right here.
So as adjutant, you would probably be back of the actual fighting forces, would you?
As adjutant to begin with. I was at one shack, yeah, in a sort of concrete cave like one. And the Japs were at this point before I was, you know, out of there. And then I went up on top of Cameron, and when I got up the old Cameron, well, the old man said, okay, fine, I'll take it.
So he was...
Not that I gave a shit. I was so goddamn glad to get up away from him and get up there.
A company commander would be like an advancement, would it? Like you would...
Well, certainly.
Handle the...
Yeah, sure. Adjutant's fine, but they all wanted to be company commander after that, and I was given the company. After all, the company was covered by this time, and we knew it, and the remnants were up there, and let's take them off, Fardell. And crossing this gap, the Japs knew we were trying to get across, and they opened up an artillery, and there was a shell landing about every 30 seconds.
Did you lose a lot of men on the way up there?
No. I refused to go across the way. The old man told me. So there was a place, I wanted to take this. There was a place where I crawled, hanging on like this, and a little ledge, you know, where the mountain passes like, I got all the guys across. Thin line. Mm-hmm. And we crawled up the mountain. We got up and out without losing any guy. But they knocked it off.
How long did you were there for? What? Probably a week after that?
3 days.
And then was that the total surrender, or was that just A Company?
There's no total surrender till the last Christmas Day. I was down then. See, first of all, up on camp, noticed our boys down in B Company at a little middle gap in here, the gap between Mount Cameron and Mount Nicholson. They got ambushed, and the guys were all lying in the road. And we had a Vickers machine gun up there, and looking down, the Japs came out during the day to search these bodies, and eventually got a big pile of them in the room. No Japs got out there. Finally, there was more Jap bodies than Canadians. But they were so damn mad that night they came up and knocked us out. So we went from there back. The old man put us into rest and had some troops up at Wanchai, formed a new line. Then I went down to a place near Little Bennett's Hill. I see it here. Mm-hmm. And by a water reservoir. You see the water reservoir here on this map. Mm-hmm. There's where my line was, right behind it. So we had a perfect defense from this point to this point, well covered with all kinds of natural obstacles. And that's where we were when the war was over. And we had our defense in depth from Little Hunk, from Bennett's Hill, from the reservoir, this reservoir here, in depth right up to the peak. So we were going to just give ground very slowly from there on. Then the war was over. Because on Christmas Day, of course, all these white flags were flying all over the place.
You must have known or must have had some kind of idea that it couldn't last too long with the number of men you had.
It was hopeless from the very start because, as far as we were concerned, we neither had the equipment nor we had no equipment of any kind. In fact, we had no ammunition to speak of. In fact, these fellows, when they gave up, they really ran out of ammunition. Mm-hmm. And what machine guns we had, we borrowed from the Middlesex. And finally wound up with mostly automatic weapons, and the Japanese used to say about the Grenadiers, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, machine gun. That's a Grenadier. But every time they met Grenadiers, that meant a lot of automatic weapons. And we used to set up for night firing, and if we thought they were in the area, and we have little scouts out, and we got some Japanese concentration of small amounts even in a certain area, we had to set up for night firing, we used to hammer the hell out of them, even at midnight, without any warning. So it kind of scared them off a little bit.
And where were you? You were back down here?
Down here by this here reservoir. Mm-hmm. At the foot of Bennett's Hill. We had a company up in Bennett's Hill, too. Mm-hmm. And they were attacked. We were able to help them. We were in good defensive position.
They took over the reservoir, too, didn't they, after a period of time? Didn't they get the water reservoir?
That's where the beginning was. The reservoir was the beginning. Taitan is the name of the reservoir, which is in New Territories, the biggest water supply for Hong Kong. And they use that water on the island as well. It's piped over. Mm-hmm. Now that reservoir was up on top of a high hill, and so steep were the sides that the British thought that the Japanese would never get up there and never bother. And, of course, when the Japs did get up there, they were overlooking the back door of the Scots.
Mm-hmm.
Too bad. So they were wiped out practically without any trouble at all. Now, we sent over a company under Bowman to D Company to help the withdrawal of our troops from the mainland.
How many companies were there in the Winnipeg Grenadiers?
Well, the usual four companies, the headquarters company and the reinforcement company.
Mm-hmm.
A, B, C, and D, and headquarters and reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
That's one company over in the Central Battalion.
Did you did you deal with the Japanese as a company commander when the surrender took place on the 25th? Or did they, was there any...
Well,
sort of
we were ordered. You see, we received orders from our own people to stack our arms and make our way under a white flag towards Wanchai Gap.
Mm-hmm.
And carry on, if not stopped by that time, carry on until we got to Victoria Parks, I think it was. I know the Japs surrounded us at Wanchai Gap, and they kept us there all day long. And then that night they got us in a room, and the fellow got lost, the Japanese soldier guiding us down, he got lost, and he put us in a room that's like a black hole of Calcutta, and we were just standing up by it, we just squeezed in like sardines there for the night. Anyway, the next day we got to our own people. And later on we went to North Point Camp, which is still on the island.
Did they treat you fairly at this point, or were they brutal to you?
Well, they were quite happy the thing was over for them, and the fact that we're concerned, that Japanese were so happy that the war was over for them, that they weren't bad. And matter of fact, they found my guitar in the middle of a battlefield, middle of the road, how it escaped, or it being blown up, I don't know. But they brought this guitar and wanted to know who owned it. We were about 100 grenadiers together. And of course, everybody pointed at me, and I was trying to duck behind a fellow. They brought it over and learned what they wanted. And they opened it up and pointed at me and handed me the guitar, and I sat down and started playing for them. Put on a concert. After an hour or so, I got real good and tired. Did anybody else want to play guitar? And thank God there was a few other guitar players. You can carry on for 3 hours entertaining themselves.
And then you went, after this, did you go back to Shamshui Po right away?
Or? Oh no, we were in North Point for quite a long time. That's where our trouble started. We had some of our boys try to escape there. Four of them got out and during a rainstorm, and they had a leaky boat, and they were caught, and I understand they were executed. And we stayed up all night on parade, and standing to attention in the rain. It's punishment, and they took a... They had parties of five, you know, everybody was a member of a five group, and if one did something wrong, they'd take the other four in.
Mm-hmm.
So the RSM, not the RSM, but who was it? Sergeant Major Adams. And another fellow were hauled in, and they were put in a horrible situation, living in a cell that they never took, they never cleaned the latrines or anything, and finally they were just laying in their own stuff. And after a month they came out of their putty gray, and they still lived. God save me, real bad time. It's punishment.
Did they maintain the regimental order of the Canadian system, or did they break
it
up?
Fortunately for us, they left us handle ourselves. It saved them a lot of trouble, so we carried on our own organization, and we had our own company organization, and I was then the company commander, and we carried on this way all through the war.
Mm-hmm.
Except this party of the five, which they dreamed up, which was to keep us in line. And of course, the officer was always punished for anything that was wrong, because you're supposed to have control of his own troops. It's a very simple matter then to control the regiment through controlling the officers.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, that's where all Johnny or Norris got, you know, horribly beaten and died as a result of it. Because he was blamed for two men coming 3 minutes late on parade from hospital duty. That's how they were later on, of course. At the time the war ended, they were not so bad. But we got in different troops, I think, to guard us, and they were kind of rough for a while.
Did you have medics with you, or were you relying on the Japanese for medical supplies?
Well, we had our own doctors, but they couldn't get the medicine they wanted. We'd had a diphtheria epidemic, they couldn't get any serum of any kind. So they set up an isolation thing, and did the best they could, and fortunately they did very well considering very few deaths of diphtheria. And they were able to eventually get some kind of supplies in by, I understand, trading with the Japanese and giving them some VD care, because the Japs all had venereal disease, most of these troops. And these come to our doctors for better treatment than their own doctors. And then for that, they our doctors get medicine from them,
mm-hmm.
if they want it.
How long was it before they took you over to Shamshui Pole?
Well, it seemed to me, and this was our time when all the hell, that we left for Shamshui Pole, it seems to me, at towards New Year's, the next year. This is, maybe I'm haywire, but it seems like December. It seems to me we're celebrating something. Maybe it's in the fall. But time went all the hell on us, and we didn't remember very much. I know that too. Haywire. I know one thing about Good Friday was the time that officers got their first pay. And we had quite a party with it. What you could buy, well, you could buy with cigarettes.
Did you still get pay, or like did the Japanese give you any kind of?
That's right. They gave us the Good Friday of 1942. That was payday for the first time. Then they made us have a bank account in their bank. We never saw that, of course. And all we could buy with money was the cigarettes.
And so the whole works were taken to whatever time it was, were taken to Shamshui Po. Was this just Winnipeg Grenadiers, or were the
Royal Rifles? Well, everybody, the Canadians,
mm-hmm.
everybody.
How about the Royal Scots and the...
yes, the whole works. Everything went over there. And then later on, they divided the senior officers from the rest of us. And I was made acting commanding officer of Grenadiers, and the captain of the Royal Rifles was made acting commanding officer of the Royal Rifles. And the senior officers went to another camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what their idea was there, but they thought they could have better control. And of course, before the war was over, they brought the seniors back again.
What were conditions like in that place, in the barracks?
Well, pretty horrible. You have to get on living on a bowl of rice and boiled chrysanthemum leaves and any kind of greens, didn't matter. And we never had any butter or things. And of course, no milk, and no meat, no sugar. We had a little orchestra. We were playing for the Japanese one time, and we learned Japanese music. And we paid for some Japanese troops, and in return for that, they gave us some tea. And I remember every time I went down to the sugar bowl there, boys used to empty the sugar bowl in each cup, and they kept filling it up again, and they'd laugh their heads off. But we got a lot of sugar in us that day. Never seen a sugar.
Did the diet must have definitely weakened you, didn't it?
Well, it started the diet deficiency started to show up in North Point, because before we went to Chantilly Pool, we had showing problems of epidermolysis, and then we had beriberi problems, and pellagra. When we got over to Chantilly Pool, you get sore tongue, and you know, you wake up in the morning and only see part of a building or part of the other fellow, and that'd be completely missing, and you knew your eyes were going haywire. And then you had pellagra, and the doctors were able to get thiamine, and they had it divided amongst everybody, so they give one shot in the mouth with a little eyedropper, and that's all you got. But it did arrest the damage to the extent.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was completely cured. A lot of boys came back with bad vision, if not blindness.
Did they, when you were in the camp, if you were the senior officer or the commanding officer for the troops, did they sort of pass the commands through you to the men?
Oh yes, as far as there usually wasn't very much, but I was responsible for everything, and I had no trouble except one time I was took my turn at things, and I was really, this boiled down to mostly our own administration, but I took my turn as a sanitation officer for the month. captain of the latrines. And they were selling the latrine products to the Chinese. And this Chinese came late one morning, and they witnessed a parcel of some kind, and the boys were overflowing. Stuff was running all over the place, and they asked me what to do about it. And I said, well, I guess you'll have to dump it over the seawall. I didn't think I should have asked the senior Japanese official permission, but I didn't. So when the Chinese did come around and there was nothing to give them, what happened to it? I dumped over the seawall. Well, who ordered this? Well, it was me, of course, and I was hauled up and discovered something at this point. Japanese don't accept any excuses. So right off the bat, I said, this is all my fault. I'm to blame. Nobody else. I did it, and I'm very sorry. You didn't hit me for some unknown reason. If you make an excuse to a Japanese when anybody hauls off and wipes you down, he doesn't buy an excuse. You're to blame. So having taken all the blame, I escaped punishment. But later on, we discovered fellows were growing nice-looking tomato plants and even so much as a small banana tree in a hole in the ground near their hut. And how this happened, well, this fellow said he put some of his latrine products in the hole and made his own little garden. So we got some bright ideas and went to the Japanese and asked them if we could cultivate. Now, mind you, this ground was all reclaimed land. It was all brick and sand, and there wasn't any what you call earth. And out of this, we got permission, and we gave the Japanese the first fruits of our garden. And I worked in the garden, and we used to make trenches and other stuff, and they pour the stuff in and cover it over for about, oh, a couple of months until it turned black. And then we'd make little seedlings and things and grow them and nurse them along. And you know, our first crop, tomatoes with 2 ton. My God, we were in business. We couldn't grow much carrots. They were very stringy looking, and corn was hopeless. Tomatoes, great big juicy ones. All kinds of them.
Did they allow you to keep them, or did they take
They took a little bit for themselves, but we grew so darn much that it was plenty for everybody. Mm-hmm. The farmers. As a result of that, I think every grenadier medal was mine when he got home to Canada, if he ever got home. They're all going to be farmers. That's right.
Was there many died in Shamshiripo while you were there?
Yeah, we used to have a bugler blowing at a... Mind you, the grenadiers lost all their buglers. Every one of them was killed. And but we still had buglers of other units there. And this last post was sounding about 7 or 8 times a day. We got tired of fellows dying every day. And so we had, I don't know how many died. Daily deaths all the time. Mm-hmm. We had our own cemetery. And we had little wooden crosses. But you know, wood is very precious for Chinese. We're having fires, so they stole all the crosses for fuel. So we kept a sort of a survey of the cemetery and everything all mapped out, and we knew where everybody was. And we got a little curbstone we got a hold of, and we sort of scratched the fellow's name on the curbstone, and little ones, and we made little grave markers. And even then, we had an accurate survey or accurate map of his grave.
Did you keep a diary or a log of any kind?
Oh, lots of diaries were kept and various. Some of them embellished and so on. I didn't bother keeping one. Only funny thing, we made our own calendars and things, and we had a very accurate map. We had some smart people in the camp. Very accurate map of what the war was doing, you know, the Russians and so on. And the Japanese newspapers, the English news, were surprisingly accurate. And we were in touch with Chongqing for a while through a secret radio. And the radios were always getting caught, and we were making new ones all the time. I don't know how they made them. And we were in touch with Chongqing continually. We knew exactly what was going on. The Japanese were quite honest about reporting, except the one thing they were kind of crazy about. They didn't know how many fleets the Americans had. They call it the 58th fleet, 57th fleet. All the time, there was only one. We never moved to stay out of Japan. We followed afterwards. Except they thought they had so many fleets. So we were otherwise aware of what's going on in the world. And we used to make these electric water heaters, you know, you have one can inside of the other and a piece of wood between them, a piece of wire on each, and you dump it in the water. And we're doing that. We kind of blew up the main power plant. You know, everything went. You know, Johnny was getting quite angry, so they raided our camp and you should see the pile of homemade electrical apparatus. Gosh, it was about man high. And the next day, before you could see Jack Robinson, just as many were built. Little electric stoves, little water heaters. We had a lot of fun doing that. And oh yes, then we were, when that ran out, we were running out of wood. So every other beam in the hut was ripped out and we'd splintered up and we'd be burning fuel that way and had our own little stoves. And take a large tin can and you can make a U and just stick it in and grate the thing and then fire a little piece of wood in there and have your own little oven. You even did that, did everything.
Is this for heat or for
sure, make your own noodles. Take a little rice and do your own cooking. Then we had grinders for grinding up roasted rice into sort of a rice powder, make cakes out of it. Mind you, you wouldn't eat it now. It would be bloody awful. That time it was delicious.
It's better than what there was. Did they give you the food or did they just give you the supplies and you cooked your own?
Well, they just gave us rice and greens, that's all. And then when we got into Red Cross supplies, we used to... Well, in fact, we had a pig, for example. And that pig was suffering from malnutrition. And finally, they killed the pig. Well, take 1,000 men and one pig. Well, if you've got one little strand of meat in your bowl, you're lucky. But you could, you know, could sort of taste the pork in the rice. But they brought the bones of the pig over to the garden when they boiled it to death and we were to use it for fertilizer. But before we put it in the ground, all the gardeners sat around this big bowl and they took up these bones and they just sucked the hell out of them and got what grease you could out of it. It's kind of a picnic.
Yeah.
And of course, anything that flew around there, you know, had these little boxes and little rice and a stick in a box and wait for the bird to get in to get the rice and stuff. And by God, you eat the guy before, you know, you could say an hour was gone. The bird was eating.
Pigeons and
I think all the animals went through eating the dogs. Plus, I'm sure the rats didn't go the same way.
Were the barracks infested? Were there a lot of rats?
Oh, God, yes. The rats used to gallop across the hut just like a, you know, cavalry. Terrible.
Were you in Shamshiko all the time, or did they move you to other camps after?
Well, no, I was on a draft to go to Japan, and I was taken off the draft because they figured they couldn't use me very much. I wasn't an announcer, I wasn't a radio man, I wasn't of any use as an undertaker, so no need for undertakers in Japan. So I was taken off the draft. I'd been punched and bored before that. I think being punched and bored, the serum they gave me for dysentery did work. Well, when I came home, I was a carrier of dysentery, but I never did get it.
I don't understand what you mean by punched and boarded.
Well, punched and boarded when you get needled with serums and things to make you pure to go to Japan.
Oh, I see.
Make you safe, like you do when you get injections for typhus and other things. And they gave me an injection of what they thought was serum against the getting dysentery, and it worked. The establishment of people out there, what is this?
Did you see the people who went to Japan again?
Oh, we saw them when we gathered together at the end of the war in a place called Manila, about 20 miles out of Manila camp. 250,000 returning prisoners of war were all gathered together and then sent home hundreds of ships and planes.
Mm-hmm. Getting on to that, who found you? Who got to the camp at Shamshiko?
First guy to walk in, there was a commando, great big British commando. Just walked in like he owned it. Great big bruiser. Like one of these wrestlers you see today. And he walked in there with a Tommy gun over his lap, just, you know, just like he's going for a walk someplace. And you know something about the fellow? He looked like his eyes were like pigs, and he smelled like a damn pig too. Because, you know, funny thing, when you eat Chinese food long enough, maybe you smell like a Chinaman, but you wouldn't like to smell us like we smell right now. Mm-hmm. That's what we smelled. He smelled horrible.
How did he look? By comparison to you at that point.
Oh, he looked like a great big bruiser, that's all. Big, greasy pig. And we were just all living under a shadow and, you know, just living corpses. And all smelled the same, nothing. It's like a Chinese laundry, I guess. Mm-hmm.
And they took you straight from there to Manila, did they? Or were you still...
Well, no, we stayed there for a while, and we were out. Then the officers who were able to wiggle were enough to get some supplies for ourselves. Mind you, when the Japanese left the perimeter, I must say that the Chinese came in, the compradors, that's the merchants, mm-hmm. and said, what do you want? Well, what do you mean, what do you want? We can have anything you want. Well, we got no money or nothing. Oh, give you credit, Canada, good country. And what was it, Scotch? Sure. Meat? Sure. Well, make one of you fellows responsible and we send you a bill in Canada, that's all. So we made one of the officers responsible and we started ordering like mad. You got anything you want. Anything you want. Meat, bully beef, Scotch, anything. So from then on everything was fine.
Did you notice a change when you started on the new diet, like after being on rice for a while? Did it bother you or upset
not,
your system too?
Not so much at this point. But later on, when we got on the ship coming home, I'll tell you something. But anyway, at this point, when the ships came in, we went to the Red Cross ships or supply ships and we dragged our own supplies in. And on the way back, with a truckload of the stuff and everything we could lay our hands on, cigarettes and God knows what, we passed by a bunch of Japanese who were, had stacked their arms and they were waiting for it to be taken over and let out of where we were supposed to go. And we saw our old Sergeant Major Honda, who was a good Jap. He was a nice guy. He liked him. He liked the Canadians. He never done us any harm. So we stopped the truck and we jumped off and we yelled his name out loud and he came out. We gave him a carton of Cravenets and we gave him things for a prison camp like toothbrushes and combs and patted them on the back and said he won't be long, he'd go home soon now. And he was crying. But that's one thing we were happy we did. Then some Australians came along and they wanted looking for some of his storage and things and rifles and started questioning Honda. And Honda said he didn't know everything was done properly with him and he was a good soldier. So these fellows never saluted Honda, saluted him, they never saluted him back. And so we told these Australians, you better salute this man, he's a good guy. And we forced them to salute back. Treat the fellow properly. Because there was a few of us more than they were. And there's one good point, and we went back with our stuff to the camp. And anyway, you're talking about what happened to the fellows eating again. God, we went on the first ship, the Empress of Australia, and in the dining room, we know that the things like tomatoes and juice and all that disappeared right away. Quick, they ate the whole thing as fast as they could get to half of it. And then I was in sick bay on the American ship out of Manila, and same thing happened there. All these prisoners of war, they got on the dining room and they ate everything up before they started seeing the first course. And they started breaking out in large boils. And I realized it was a mistake personally, and I ate light and often. I never got in trouble. But those fellows ate four meals, they got real sick. It takes 3 months to get on to our way of life and prisoners of war and living on rice to exist. It takes 3 months again to get back on the kind of food we eat now. Mm-hmm. Rice.
So you came back from Manila to where? To Hawaii and then?
Manila, we got on this ship. The Gosper was a victory boat. The landing craft had been in Okinawa, 24 guns on it, and 24 landing boats. And we went from Manila to Ulithi. We went to Ulithi, we picked up a Filipino, overturned a dugout canoe and at sea, and I was in the head at the time, and the ship stopped, and picked the guy up. I got sick right there because they heaved the boat a bit, and picked this guy up, had to drop him off. So we dropped him off at Ulithi, where, as you know, General MacArthur had scattered his attack for the Philippines, that's his base. And a bunch of Americans climbed on board. They didn't give a damn where they hang on anywhere. They didn't give them where they slept or anything, because they have these tickets to go home as the time was up and they can go home. With the Canadians, of course, you don't get that sort of thing. They got on board, so I was sleeping in sick bay, and that's where I saw all these boils and things. Any old bed would do. And it teared up four from the floor, right down the bottom. And from there, we stopped in Pearl Harbor for a while, and I got a ticket to see our own Canadian hospital ship. And two out of a hat, four of us went to see our hospital ship, who had been around and never done a damn thing, really. Hadn't picked anybody up, but they wouldn't be of some use to somebody. But they certainly weren't bringing home any Canadians. But we were well on the way now. And from there, we started off for San Francisco. And I got orders at sea to proceed to Victoria. And that's where we got off the ship, Victoria.
Did people meet you in Victoria?
Yes. I know that I played in the orchestra in prison camp, and those who played in it, prison camp orchestra were given instruments that the Pope had given us. I don't even know about that story. The Pope gave the Hong Kong people, you know, prisoners of war, $40,000 to buy food, and Japanese would have wouldn't admit that they needed food, so they spent the $40,000 on musical instruments. Out of which I had a string bass, and I was given that, so I brought home a string bass, and they played on the ship all the way home, orchestra there. And I carried this thing off the ship to Victoria. And my sisters met me there. They've been waiting for you to come home. We went to Gordon Head, and there we had to be debugged and purified before we allowed to go home.
How many were there of you in this contingent?
Trouble with the grenadiers and rifles. We came home on 100 different ships and aircraft. We weren't back home at all, in what you call as a group, except a small group came on a larger ship. They could land in San Francisco, and they did a little marching. But most of the regiment, most of the people, Canadian troops, they came home and sort of odds and sods in the old way at all. But the gathering point was Gordon Head, and that's where we were all put sent home as reasonably as possible, as soon as they could be sure they debugged you. But they didn't debug me because I was a carrier, and they didn't discover it. And they got to Winnipeg, and then they forgot about it, and I was only on for 6 months. So that's a carrier of dysentery. And they kicked me out again.
What was your feeling when you got back to Canada? Were you happy, or was it anticlimactic at that point?
The funniest thing out was the feeling of being crowded. I felt pushed. I felt sort of stifled. I had to get out of there. I had to get escape. I my family wanted to look after me, do things for me, and I resented it. I don't know why. I guess I was half nuts. I was staying at the Fort Garry Hotel for 4 days only, and I went down the ticket office and I bought a ticket to New York. I told my wife we're going to New York tomorrow. And we went. You know, funny thing, I got in this New York City with all those people, and I was all alone. I felt happy. Nobody bothered me. Funny, I keep getting old.
I guess there'd be not many automobiles or anything like that in Hong Kong, in that area when you were there. That must have been quite a shock to come back to the mechanization of North America.
Well, no, that didn't want to stop. The Japanese had tremendous mechanization.
Did you do, jumping back again?
That's all right.
When you were in the prison camp, did they detail you to do work? Like, were you doing duties
for
the
Japanese? Oh, that's a good idea. Yes, sure. Everybody worked. And the officers that go out in the working parties, and they ride their work. Now, you see, they give you a little extra rice for this. Mm-hmm. If you get on a working party, you could, and you didn't have to kill yourself. We did tear down a sacred mountain. The Canadian troops did, and we had two lines running down dump carts, you know, taking earth from high ground onto low ground, filling up marshes. And it took us about a couple of years. And you know, we took that mountain down, and that is now Kai Tak International Airport, without which it never even landed anywhere a helicopter in Hong Kong. We tore it down, and Japs has got to go. The British couldn't do it because the sacred mountain. They couldn't touch the sacred mountain. Japanese didn't give a damn. They want that mountain down, and they got it down. Mm-hmm. And we put the first runways in for them. But we, here and there, I think we kind of cheated because we made it kind of thin and the little holes underneath, and finally a Japanese bomber cracked up, and we thought we'd done a good job.
Were you, towards the end of the war, if you were in touch through radio and through their newspapers, were you kind of aware that the end was coming and that you were going to get home soon?
Oh yes, we knew. We knew that it was just about over. And when the thing was over, we knew right away. There was great commotion going on. And all the troops in our perimeter all disappeared. They ran away. We stayed put, and we got, the Americans came. Eichelberger, I think, was the American general. His planes came over and they dropped down leaflets to us and told us to stay put, don't do anything. Warned us not to do anything. Stay put. Task force is coming. Behave yourself. Don't start running.
And so there was actually fighting in Hong Kong again at the end of the war, was there? Or was it just...
Not really. The Japanese were very well disciplined. Well, we'll say that for them. They turned over everything. And even their Gestapo, you know, their gendarmes or the military police, mm-hmm. last to turn over, they helped everything. They're very well disciplined people. There was no problems at all, really. None. They were very, very, very well behaved as far as I'm concerned. No fighting. God's sake, they did send out, I understand, some of these here suicide votes to try to stop the task force, but they never made it.
No shot.
Did the attitude towards the Japanese change when you knew the end was going to come? Like among the enlisted men, did they sort of get belligerent towards the Japanese?
No, they didn't. I didn't see any sign of that at all. I felt kind of sorry for the Japs when the thing was pretty well over and they come up and apologized to you. It made me kind of half sick. Why bother, you know?
Did you make friends?
Yes, I see. Sergeant Major Honda was considered a very fine friend. He was very good to the Grenadiers. They'll all remember him as doing his level best to make them comfortable, as far as he's concerned.
I guess their hands were tied too.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't have supplies either.
So they were suffering the same as we were. Tell you one instance, I was in the hospital and I heard a guy trying to puke in a perimeter. A guard was out there in the perimeter and he was puking. So I walked over to him and you know, on the inside of the wire and looked at him. He was trying to cough up something. So I thought I'd give him the water cure and I went back for a bucket of water and I got a cup and I gave him a sign to down this water and hold it down, and, you know, the old water cure and empty his stomach out. He did. Finally got the message. Gosh, he emptied his pockets with cigarettes and everything, threw them at me, and I came back to the hospital passing out cigarettes. You see, he'd been trying out some of the fish he bought and it was poisonous. And he was suffering from malnutrition same as we were. Even the poor old pigs, you know, suffered from malnutrition. Everybody had. They were cut off so badly that the American bombers come over there, they come around at night time and fly around like they owned the place, 1,000 feet up, drop the occasional bomb here and there, and the daytime guy would go up there, and he'd be up about 20,000 feet looking down on this, and some poor guy try to get out from the shore, he'd maybe get out about far enough when this guy come down and sink him, and nothing would move. The Americans were so mad, you know, because, you know, when they did lose any flyers there, they kept me feeling badly. They tortured them and killed them. So the Americans were mad at the Japs in Hong Kong. They sold them up the last few months. So they couldn't do anything.
I've heard stories about brutality. Was that all at the first of the thing, or was it? Were they mean to people all the way through? Or, I mean, you mentioned that this chap this commanding officer was really fair to you.
Well, this, of course, the sergeant major. He wasn't an officer. I mean, a sense of saying commissioner. And he had officers over him. But we had an interpreter who was born in Kamloops, called him the Kamloops Kid, Canadian. Went back to Japan and became an interpreter. He had a sort of a bad feeling about Canadians, and he did everything he could to make our life miserable. In fact, he beat up Johnny Norris so bad. In fact, he finally got hung for it. They got him in prison. I was witness to that beating. Gave evidence against this fellow, and they hung him. He had it coming. And we called the Fat Pig, was a fellow who was a senior colonel in the prison camp, and he was cruel. Some of them weren't bad, but the whole idea of Japanese being cruel, it's got to be understood in this sense that when you see them beat their own troops up, far worse than they beat your boys, start thinking about it.
You just understand it in the context.
That's exactly how they operate. They don't treat you any worse. I think they're. So that made a man stop and think.
Could you talk to the Japanese? Did any of them speak English?
Oh, God, yes. The Japanese, they mostly speak English. And I used to write music for them. I'd get out in the working party and the sentry would want me to write some music for him, a piano score of a tune he'd whistled. So I'd get the tune down and I'd orchestrate it. And he'd try it out that night. Well, he sat by me and cigarettes all the time. That ability paid off.
Was there a lot of things like that? Like you had the musical ability that sort of got you through type situations. Did other people have other?
Oh, every hobby in the world. We had a thing going there where I made a guitar for one thing, like a balalaika, and I put my own frets in and wires and all that. I did the whole thing, and for that I got on a sort of a board. A supervisory board of guild something or other craft, and I was a judge, and these guys were busy doing anything, you know. Mm-hmm. They'd make shoes or make anything at all, anything that was good. They'd had them going in competition, in which we gave a prize of a packs of goods or something, which was wild. So they're busy doing something. They taught astronomy, they taught navigation, they had schools going, they taught languages, and we had all the professors from the university there, and they were working away like mad, and things were going full belt. You have medical society there too as well, believe it or not. And they used to meet regularly. And I was teaching the Portuguese how to play their own instrument, the guitar, and teaching them music. They used to play by numbers. Mm-hmm. I had a class of Portuguese, and one of them, my pupils, is quite a fine guitarist in Hawaii, and has been ever since the war. And says that Captain Bardell taught him everything. Well, I worked on that fellow, but he got it naturally. But, you know, I was reading one time these books you get, you know, in your prison camp. A fellow wrote a book about human behavior, and, you know, I never read things about philosophy. But there's nothing else to read, I have to read. A fellow named John Dewey. He made a flat statement in this book where it says, musicians are born, not made. He's nuts. He says, why all these school teachers go broke? But that is the truth. People teaching music, you should test the fellow if he's born or not, born with it, eh? However, I tried to prove him wrong. The fellow says, go and prove him wrong. So I had a fellow, I picked a real good one. Never studied music before, and extra minor certificate, and he was intelligent looking, and he could sing nicely and all that. Well, I broke my heart to that fellow for 6 months, and I gave him an extra month, and I finally went around apologizing. You know, he didn't have that something, you know, a fellow's got to have coordination. He didn't have it. John Dewey was right. He was right. I was wrong. I apologize to John Dewey. The old man lived to be about 90. I guess he died since the war. So also we had competition going on all the time.
Competition is kind of an American or North American thing. Did they sort of, did you institute that, or did the Japanese institute the competitions?
Oh, no. It just sort of started. Nobody really instituted it. For example, now, when we were starting the orchestra, everybody had to read. And there was a fellow, quite a fair guitarist, you know, but he refused to read the music. And I said, for heaven's sake, man, I can take anybody and in 3 months' time teach them everything you know and have read music besides. Then what are you doing? And I did it. And this boy became a good musician. And we fired this other fellow out of the band, and this man I made out of nothing in 3 months became a member of the orchestra. Played Moment Musicale on 4 flats on the stage with 3 guitars.
Did they encourage this? Did they
Japanese
fraternize with your
Well, the Japanese used to like our music and like our shows. They used to come and sit in on them, you know, watch them. They got a kick out of it. Mm-hmm. And finally, the Japanese who liked these here got given credit. These sulfur baths. They instituted their Japanese baths in the prison camp, and it was very enjoyable to have a nice hot boiling bath. So towards the end, this is last year, they tried to make. They're very clean people, thank God, and thank God we had water there, and thank God the reservoir was working, and we had lots of water, and I couldn't say the soap was any good, bloody hot soap, and the Japanese blankets, just cotton, towels, not much of that, they kind of skimpy, but we could keep clean. We ran around the fanduchi, you know what the fanduchi is?
Sure.
Loincloth, just a piece of cloth and a string on it, and that's what you wear, and you had wooden clogs. If you ever wore wooden shoes, or your own shoes, leather shoes, you could wear them out in no time. So, barefooted or wood clogs, I think.
And you had sort of the run outdoors, did you? Like they didn't keep you locked up in
Oh, no. We were inside of a large camp over the perimeter, and by the night time, they had a sort of a white mark to the biffy, to the latrine.
Mm-hmm.
And you better get off that line, because they were kind of free with shoot the guns out. And they'd challenge you, and you'd say, Benjo, Benjo. Benjo means you go into the camp. And we say, Shigator, you mean you're on duty. So, allowed to go there. But this Japanese friend of mine who I was writing music for, he was one time on a sentry post up on a tower. And he waved at me and he told me to come as close. He signaled the other fellows to lay off. And I come up close, he tossed me a couple of packs of cigarettes. So I made a friend. another time I was going to Biffy and the Japanese sentry was in the middle of the camp and the moon was coming out, and he looked at me and he waved at me. Now waving at you as a Japanese is a sign for you to come to him. You find that the hard way. You find out that the hard way, because When he waves, if you don't come, he can come on property with his butt.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up to him and waited for him to say something or do something. And he put his hands together and he looked up at the sky, at the moon, and he said, "Mi Cristo, mi Cristo. What are you trying to tell me? You're a Christian, for heaven's sake." When I got loose from him, I went back to the padre's hut, and I said, "Look, my gosh, you know, you're guided by a Christian this night. Come out and take a look." And they wouldn't. Oh, they just didn't get wrong.
When you got back to Winnipeg, were the stories or were the newspapers at that time running stories about the Hong Kong veterans, or was there any sort of word that you people were coming home? Or?
Oh yes, they knew we were coming, and they had it all lined up. And for instance, they knew I was on the train. For instance, I got to Gordon Head now, and I noticed a fellow from Winnipeg who was from a Free Press, and nobody would talk to him. I felt sorry for him. He was a newspaper reporter and nobody would talk to him. He had an assignment, come all the way from Winnipeg to get a story. So I said, "What do you want?" He said, "I want a story." I said, "Okay, let's give it." So he sat down in the corner and I talked to him. And it all came out on page one, the Free Press.
Mm-hmm.
And I predicted most things like Osborne's BC and things like that, what they had evidence for, and things that happened, which were all written up, and they're all true, fortunately, for me. And he got a good write-up and he tried to get home again, and justify his trip. So on the train, I was the only Hong Kong veteran on that train, officer, because I got home a little earlier than the rest of them. Because I had four sisters there. I told the commander, I said, these sisters of mine, they're nurses, they won't go back to work long as I'm here. And they've been losing a lot of time, and they've been out of work for a whole week now. Right? You better let me out of here so they can go back to work. So he let me out. And I got home. And to tell you the truth, you know, a couple of these wealthy guys out of Vancouver got me in their compartment, and I stayed there, and I had lots to eat and lots to drink, and I think I really tied one on. Because, you know, when I got to Winnipeg, I was much the worse for wear, and people thought that was, gee, gosh, he went to a lot of trouble in prison camp, you know, look at him, it's a hell of a big hangover, you know.
You came back.
Yeah.
Did you make your own liquor in the camp? Or was
they did. They asked, and I got very sick, and I wrapped up the mosquito netting, and I woke up one night, I was really puking all over the place. I think it was a little woo alcohol in it, because they made their own booze, of course. Yes, they always do that. And I got sick on that stuff. Boy, oh boy. Never again. I'm sure it's alcohol. Yes. Oh, we bought some wine from the Japanese. The wine in Hong Kong is kind of strong. It's like whiskey. And I give a century of mine a couple of solid gold cups, and I didn't even damn well get over it. Get me some booze, and he bought me two bottles of Chinese wine. One of those fellows had a birthday, so we celebrated. Gosh, that is powerful stuff. Took the head off him. We can get that when you want. And there's another thing about Hong Kong, you can get anything you want there. Some of our dope addicts, you know, you always have a dope addict in the region, they get all the dope they want. All times.
Were they heroin addicts?
Anything.
Really?
Sure. Just like you're out in the middle of everything. Anything you want. Like
dope. Did they come back hooked on them?
Well, they were hooked before they went, you know. Right? Of course, you know, Hong Kong is supposed to be the worst place in the world. One man in 50 in Hong Kong would tell me he's dope addict.
Did you, before the fighting started, this is going back again, but was it sort of pleasant in Hong Kong before the fighting broke out, or was there always apprehension that the Japanese were going to come?
Well, one thing you didn't notice was the business of a balloon. A balloon is always going up and down, balloon going up, mm-hmm. Always alarms, always getting excited. And finally, I guess they got, you know, too much of this sort of thing, and they got kind of sleepy on the job.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was talking to a British intelligence officer as adjutant, making an inspection trip with Jim Jenkins Lyon, visiting Royal Scott. So I asked this British intelligence officer, "What's the score?" This is Saturday night. Sunday, then Monday, the Japs hit us Monday morning. Saturday night. This is December the 5th, our time. December the 6th, your time. I just keep saying that. And he said, "No, there's nothing doing it." that time, of course, there must have been 40,000 troops right across about a mile from the border. Because they weren't, I see where they're going.
And you didn't have any, from what I've read, there was no ground vehicles? No air support?
No trucks, no, our trucks didn't arrive.
The trucks ended up in Manila or something?
Well, where they went, I don't even know. There was another ship, and they were diverted. But we never got any mortars, just a token, couple of mortars. We borrowed from somebody else. Our mortars didn't arrive. Our end gun carrier did not arrive. Our trucks did not arrive. None of our equipment arrived. So we were just borrowing the stuff. The poor old transport officer had to commandeer some broken down old trucks. He had a heck of a time.
I also understood that I was told that the main line of defense was along the south, the southern side.
Oh yes,
of
you're
the
thinking about
because
the yeah, the whole setup, all the yes, all the pillboxes, everything was pointed to sea, and what we had pointing to the mainland was practically nothing.
Because they were sure it was going to come from
our big guns. Everything was pointed to sea. We had a good artillery. Group down there that all kinds of setups there to take care of any beach landings in certain areas, but not where they landed. We didn't have that area set up. That was Lai Moon. We had Pulse Bay set up in Taitan Bay and so on, where we covered from the mainland. So we had to give up these little concrete dugouts. Anyway, they weren't very well made in the first place. And dig our little potholes elsewhere in the opposite direction. That's the truth. Because they make a hit on any of our pillboxes, just like, oh, just go through it like nothing. Because I think Hong Kong has a bad habit of, I don't know, what do you call it, cheating, chiseling on contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have the proper mix. It wasn't very hard stuff. It wasn't reinforced. Anymore. Even with the roads, all the communication system was only a few inches below the surface. And a shell would land and bust into the road and break up the water supply and break up the telephone communication and everything else. So in no time at all, the only communication we had was our own lines, our own telephone lines.
Mm-hmm.
We'd always be breaking them and then repairing them ourselves.
How did you get books? Like, did the Japanese people give you books, or did you have a little black market on books and magazines?
Funny thing about that, people liked books. They carried books with them,
mm-hmm.
and had in their pocket.